From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, why America's debate over smoking is at a turning point. The nation's biggest tobacco companies were dealt a blow last week when a judge ruled that the FDA can regulate tobacco as a drug. We'll talk with Philip Hiltz, author of Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up, about what brought us to this point and why big tobacco may be about to make some startling admissions. Also, emergency room physician Joe Sachs. He's a consultant to the popular TV drama series ER. He'll talk about what it takes to make the show as realistic as his own ER. And coming out of the closet prime time, TV critic David Bianculli gives us a preview of tonight's long-awaited episode of Ellen. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Seven men who were going to join 13 separatists barricaded in a home in Fort Davis, Texas, are being held by police. Authorities say the men were stopped this morning in Pecos as they were driving toward the house where members of the Republic of Texas are holding off police officers. Authorities say there were weapons in one of the two vehicles the men were riding in. Texas officials remain hopeful the situation will be peacefully resolved, but the Republic of Texas members say they'll never surrender. Attorney General Janet Reno is being criticized by Republicans on Capitol Hill today because she's refused to call for an independent counsel to investigate Democratic campaign fundraising. Reno says the standard in the law is clear on when to call for an independent counsel, and she says so far the evidence does not call for one. But she says she keeps abreast of any new developments in the case in case she may need to change her decision.
I will always welcome additional information, additional legal arguments. I will constantly review all the matters presented to me in the most thorough and constructive way possible to see that the law is complied with.
Republicans are not mollified. Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch says Reno's refusal to engage such a counsel does not add respect, admiration, or public confidence in the Justice Department. Reno says she will not violate her oath of office because of pressure from Congress, the media, or anywhere else, because that would be wrong. An explosion at an arms depot in central Albania has killed at least 22 people. It's the latest in a series of blasts across Albania where people have been looting hundreds of unguarded arsenals during months of civil unrest. The BBC's Joanna Robertson reports from Tirana.
Overstretched and meager emergency services rushed to the remote scene of the blast high in the central Albanian mountains. They found villagers trying to recover maimed bodies from the wreckage. The police were anxious to clear the area, fearing that fire would spread to adjoining tunnels and cause further explosions. Many local residents refused to leave, but instead continued their desperate search to find missing relatives amongst the carnage. The arsenals near to Burrell are similar to those across Albania, with weapons packed into a series of underground tunnels. Police reports say that those who died were in one of the tunnels when the explosion occurred, sending flames roaring through to adjoining passages. Unconfirmed reports say that a match or burning torch carried by the villagers ignited the stores of dynamite, grenades, and landmines.
Joanna Robertson reporting. The Canadian military is working fast to repair a broken dike near Winnipeg, Manitoba. About 80 homes are being evacuated after the temporary dike cracked. The houses are not in grave danger, and the evacuation is precautionary. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 69.5 points at 7,031. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher for a third consecutive day. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The market's rise is being led by computer-related issues, which were boosted when the Wall Street Journal reported that Goldman Sachs is recommending Compact Computer and Intel. The article also said Goldman is bullish on Citicorp, which is leading money center bank issues higher. The stock market is also being boosted by strength in Treasury bond prices. Despite this morning's stronger-than-expected reading on first-quarter economic growth, investors are focusing on reports of a possible balanced budget agreement. Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan is on record saying that Congress would be rewarded if a balanced budget were to be reached. I'm Doug Krisner.
The report out today that shows strong economic growth finds the gross domestic product increased at an annual rate of 5.6% in the first quarter of the year. It's the strongest increase in a decade and was fueled by consumers. They nearly doubled their rate of spending and at a much higher rate than analysts were expecting. Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky says the United States will lodge copyright violation charges against Denmark, Sweden, Ireland, and Ecuador at the World Trade Organization. Barshefsky says the United States is protesting those countries' failure to protect U.S. copyrights and other intellectual property. Barshefsky warns Washington may also start similar cases against Greece and Luxembourg if they fail to meet their obligations under an international agreement protecting intellectual property. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 69.5 points at 7,031. The Nasdaq is up 13 points at 1255. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross. It's been a rough couple of weeks for tobacco companies. Several more states' attorneys general have filed suit against the industry, hoping to recoup the costs of paying for smoking-related illnesses, making the total number of states 24. Individual cases against specific tobacco companies are making their way through various court systems around the country. And last Friday, a federal judge in North Carolina ruled that the federal government, meaning the Food and Drug Administration, has the authority to regulate cigarettes and smokeless tobacco. This is a huge defeat for tobacco companies, who have lobbied long and hard to keep the FDA's hands off tobacco, fearing the agency would take measures to regulate the amount of nicotine in cigarettes. The judge also ruled that the FDA has no authority to restrict tobacco advertising and promotions, which was a blow to anti-smoking forces. We invited Philip Hilps to join us today to put this news in context. He writes about health and science for the New York Times and is the author of the book Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up, which was published last year. He says what's truly significant about this recent ruling is that for the first time, a court has labeled nicotine a drug.
The law says that the agency in the government that is supposed to be watching drugs, who sells them, how they're sold, what's a drug, what's not a drug, is the Food and Drug Administration. And because of some peculiarities in history, tobacco had been left out of that. And so for years, people have been trying to put it back in and say, this is, after all, a drug. Let's go ahead and have FDA regulate it. But then David Kessler, at the head of the FDA in 1994, said, we're going to investigate this and we are going to put together enough information to convince everybody that nicotine is a drug. This is what the companies intend. They intend to use it as a drug. And he did that. And so he then declared, okay, nicotine is a drug. FDA will regulate it from now on, despite the history. And then the companies came in and said, no, wait a minute. We're going to court. We're going to block that. And what we have now is the result of that fight. And the court, and this is a court in Greensboro, North Carolina, tobacco country, a judge who understands the companies because he's worked with them. He represented tobacco farmers himself. So this is their best venue. And this judge quite clearly said the FDA is right. Nicotine is a drug. Cigarettes are a drug delivery device, and it should be regulated.
Now, the other half of the judge's decision said that the FDA could not restrict tobacco advertising or the promotion of tobacco products. On what legal grounds did he make this argument?
Yeah, it was kind of a narrow ground. What he said was, if anybody's going to be regulating the advertising of a product, it's got to be the FTC, which is the agency normally that does that sort of thing. And in the law, the FDA, it says the FDA can regulate sale, manufacture, but it doesn't say advertising. Normally with drugs, you don't regulate the advertising in the way that you'd regulate, say, the Marlboro Man, because drugs normally aren't handled that way. So what he said was the FDA law doesn't say you should handle advertising. The FTC law says you should. So he said, if you're going to do it, let the FTC do it. Do not let the FDA do it. But he also made a point. He said, I'm not going to rule on the general issue of whether advertising constitutes free speech and that kind of thing. Not the constitutional issue. He stayed away from that. Just on the narrow legal grounds, he said FDA is the wrong agency to be doing it.
So Joe Camel will be around for a while.
Yes. At least until the companies decide not to use him.
Are you surprised at all about this judge from North Carolina, the country's number one tobacco state, that this judge issued this particular ruling? Back in the 70s, he did represent tobacco companies as a private attorney. Many people are fairly surprised by his strong ruling. Are you?
I was surprised. I thought it would go the other way. I thought he would find some grounds to protect the companies. If there's anybody who could see this from the company's point of view, it would have been him. But I read his ruling, and what you can see as he goes through it, what he's thinking is, the law, and this is actually pretty clear, the law says if an agency's job is to regulate something like drugs and they do a reasonable interpretation of what the law says, then they should go ahead. And the only body that can stop them is Congress. Congress can change their marching orders. But once Congress has given the marching order, says, FDA, you regulate drugs, they're doing it in a reasonable way, they ought to go ahead. And so he said, you can't deny it. It's a reasonable thing for the FDA to be doing.
How do the courts define a drug? And, of course, this has been one of the issues which has made this such a contentious issue.
Yeah. The main thing is it says, the law says, anything that affects the structure or function of the body and that the seller of it intends for it to do that. So in this case, you have the tobacco coming into the lungs, and it's affecting the lungs, of course. The tobacco itself is tearing up the lungs. But mainly what we're talking about is the nicotine, which goes directly into the bloodstream, up to the brain, across to receptors all over the brain, and creates this buzz, this simultaneous calm and alertness, which smokers enjoy. That's the effect of a drug. And then the question is intent. Mm-hmm. Do the companies and have the companies marketed this product with the intention of getting the nicotine from their plant into the lungs of the smokers? And the FDA investigation, which took a couple of years, found all the internal evidence which suggests that the companies knew perfectly well what they were doing. They regulated the amount of nicotine in there. They didn't go too high or too low. They made sure plenty was being delivered and so on. So the answer was, yes, the companies intended to get nicotine to their smokers. And that's all you have is it is a drug and it was intended.
When you look at this particular ruling and the fact that states' attorneys general have sued tobacco companies to recover some of the costs of smoking of smokers within their own states, is the tide beginning to turn against the tobacco industry?
I think so. I think what has happened here, this is all of one piece. You had a time in 1952 and 53 when tobacco was king. Half the population was smoking. It was in the movies. And there was a crisis when the scientific data came in that showed this is causing a huge epidemic of disease. Cigarettes specifically are causing this epidemic of lung cancer and heart disease. But the companies fought that and struggled to a standstill. So for the last 40 years, not much has happened. But then beginning in 1994, we had a sudden breakout. Whistleblowers coming out, huge amounts of documents, the FDA declaring that it was going to investigate and try to regulate the nicotine as a drug. And so the thing broke. And at that point, all this information feeds into the normal processes of American society. You're talking about courts, the Justice Department, Congress, debates everywhere, newspapers. And as it works its way through the system from 1994 till now, you can see the companies losing one after another. There was a loss in court in Florida. The 24 attorneys general now have gone into court against them. One item after another, they're gradually, this information is working its way through the system.
In March, the Liggett Company, maker of Chesterfield, made a startling admission. Quote, "We at Liggett know and acknowledge that cigarette smoking causes health problems, including lung cancer, heart and vascular disease, and emphysema." What does this statement represent, coming from a small tobacco company, but coming from a tobacco company?
It represents the great desire of the executives of the companies and the scientists at the companies to get out from under the burden that they've been carrying for 40 years. They're as aware, much more aware, in fact, of all the details of what cigarettes do than the rest of us. They really know it, but they've been blocked because of a strategy they picked a while back, legally blocked from being out front about it. And for the last 40 years, that hasn't mattered too much because what's happened is their profit profits have kept up year after year, and the number of smokers has been still relatively high. But now they're facing a real problem. They really may be attacked not only in this country, but their worldwide sales would be threatened if they started losing suits one after another, and if the Justice Department indicts them, and if, and if, and if. So they need to get out from under this denial phase and get into a point where they can negotiate directly with members of Congress, with lawyers, with the public at large. They must make a deal with the public at large about how we're going to handle cigarettes in society. And the first thing they have to do is come clean. And so that's what's happened with Liggett, and now it's beginning to happen with the other companies.
The Liggett settlement included using 25% of pre-tax income over the next 25 years to pay for public service announcements, and I assume warnings, even more warnings about cigarette smoking. Is there more that they agreed to, and did they agree to use the word addictive?
Yes, they agreed to a lot more. Probably the most important thing they agreed to was to turn over all their files, all these papers, which shows what they've known over the years, that they knew it was addictive, that they knew it was harmful, that they were, and this was a really incredible admission, that they did directly target children and intended to as young as 12, 13, 14 years old. These kind of admissions they made, and they said they will turn over their papers and they will testify. All their executives will go into court and testify against the other companies. So that's really significant turnaround. Of course, it doesn't cost them much financially to do this, mm-hmm. but it's a big thing for the plaintiffs to have these people in court fighting against the other tobacco executives. And I think that's probably the single greatest reason why the executives from RJR and Philip Morris are now themselves negotiating, because it's going to be hard for them to go into court and argue against Liggett.
Well, with all these negotiations going on and with more and more documents coming to light, do the tobacco companies, and I guess I'm thinking of the big ones, do they still maintain that there's no particular health risk associated with smoking? Do they still hold to that?
Well, this is kind of a funny question. In court, when you ask them, and there were depositions a few days ago in Florida, the head of RJR, Schindler, was asked these questions. And he said, as they have said all along, no, I don't believe it's harmful. No, I don't believe it's addictive. This is what he's saying in court under oath.
Right.
On the other hand, privately and at the table of these negotiations, they really have a very different feel about what they say. They say, well, yeah, you know, there is a problem. We know. We're going to admit that and so on. But they can't do it legally in a formal setting. So because the negotiations are going on, you have this kind of two things going at the same time. Eventually, it'll be resolved. Presumably, when the negotiations are over, they will be able to finally admit it. But legally, if they admit it, it gets them in trouble.
How, I'm wondering, though, because these are people who are testifying under oath, how they even say that and whether they come down to saying things like, well, there's no actual proof, or there are, I assume there are studies. I mean, you can find a study to prove just about anything or not prove just about anything. How do they position that in court?
They themselves have a lot of documents showing what cigarettes do, and they acknowledge that their own scientists have demonstrated that cigarettes cause various kinds of illness and so on. But they don't want to say proof. They say, we don't actually have the final proof. They say, well, it's a risk factor. And I think you have to ask a psychological question here, because they can't legally admit it. Their lawyers tell them, don't admit it. Don't say directly it causes it, because that'll get us in trouble. But so what you have is the heads of the companies saying what they believe they have to say in court, while privately they probably have a different opinion. In fact, I don't know about Schindler, but I have talked to some other tobacco company executives privately who are quite straight about it. They say, absolutely, of course it causes these problems. Of course it causes disease. But they can't do it publicly. So it's a difficult psychological bind for them, in a sense. They'd like to be able to admit it, but it could hurt their industry if they do, at least now. Maybe 2 weeks from now, when the negotiations are over, they will be able to.
What about the question about, and again, I guess looking at proof and what tobacco industry folks are willing to say in court and what they're willing to say when they're negotiating with attorneys general or perhaps members of Congress. Are they willing to make the link between smoking and addiction?
Yes. The Liggett has done that already, and the companies at the table have said or suggested that they will do that also, that they are willing to admit that it is addictive, that they have targeted children, and that it does cause cancer, heart disease, emphysema, and so on. That will be one of the results, probably, of the negotiation if it's successful. And they have offered to do that, assuming they can have what they need. And from their point of view, of course, that is they need to keep their business alive. They need to have some kind of immunity from the number of suits out there and so on.
Philip Hiltz is our guest on Fresh Air today. He's a writer for The New York Times, covers health and science. Last year came out with a book called Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. And we're talking about the various lawsuits that are making their ways through the court system dealing with tobacco companies. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is New York Times writer Philip Hiltz, and we're talking about smoking and the tobacco industry. You know, when you think about the anti-smoking education campaign in the last couple of decades in this country, several surgeon generals, including C. Everett Koop, coming out very strongly against tobacco. And then you look at the numbers of teenagers, the increasing numbers of teenagers that are smoking. Is there a danger of making smoking so forbidden that teenagers will do it because it's their way of rebelling in those adolescent years, that way of sort of defining themselves against the culture?
Yes, I think that's what's happened so far. And the ads, the PSAs, the education campaign so far hasn't dented that. The fact is that the teenage smoking is going back up.
Yeah.
That's a good indication that the one image, that is the image of being tough and independent and smoking helps give you an identity, is succeeding. And the other image of death and destruction that will come to you later on is not succeeding. The only way to deal with that is, and if you have any faith in advertisers, you can assume that there are ways to get to the psychology of teenage smokers, but they haven't been tried yet. And in fact, the people who know this best and have outlined this are the tobacco companies themselves in confidential documents. They talk about what would have an effect on teenagers, but they've never been used by the other side.
Well, what do they say? Please.
What they say is, for example, at the bottom of the desire to smoke is insecurity. The teenagers are who start smoking are less secure than the average teenager. And they're more worried about themselves, and they need this badge more than anyone. And what the teenagers fear is that people will see them as more insecure and more needy and more of a problem personality. So what the companies have done is they've hidden that by saying, if you smoke, it's going to give you a boost. You're going to look more manly or more macho or more free or whatever. What the companies fear is that the other side will see this and go after the insecurity and say, one teenager to another, you realize when you pick that up, everybody knows you're more insecure, that psychologically you have more problems than the rest of us, that you're in fact weaker willed than the rest of us. If you went with that line, you'd have a much bigger effect. Of course, it's not easy to do. You'd have to have professional advertising people doing it. Right. You'd have to package it the right way and have enough dollars to get it across so that it's a competing message. But that's the one thing that has not been tried and the thing that the companies in their documents say they fear.
We've been talking about some of the legal rulings and tobacco in the last month or so, but I wonder whether there's now pressure on politicians to do something more in Congress. And I know from the last election, I think there was some $6.8 million in soft money that went to the 96 election, and this is from the Center for Responsive Politics. About 85% of that went to the Republican Party for their party organizations and the get out the vote and all the things that soft money can do. But I wonder, as pressure is exerted more from the public and more information comes out about what tobacco companies know about tobacco products, whether that's really going to change what happens in Congress.
Yeah, so the landscape is completely different than it was. Over the last 40 years, what you had is the tobacco lobbies had a high presence in Congress. They were there with the money when the people needed it. And then when the votes came, the votes were always private. They were always small. They were never noticed. The issue was never out there in a big way. So it was quite easy for the people in Congress, the senators and representatives, to go along with tobacco, take the money, because it was never a big deal in the district. It meant nothing. Now the situation has just turned around. The issue is big and getting bigger. It is going to be a big, bitter fight when it gets to Congress. And the representatives are no longer going to be able to do anything quietly. If they take the money, they're going to be marked for it, and then they're going to have to argue for it. So it's a very different situation, and you can see the politicians one by one turning around on it. And a number of them recently have said, okay, no more tobacco money for me. These are the more liberal ones. There's still a large number of congressmen taking a large amount of money, but the situation is quite different now. And it will end up in Congress. There's almost no way around that. After these negotiations, if there's some kind of settlement worked out, it doesn't automatically happen. You have to take it to some body to ratify. Some way society itself is putting the stamp on the deal.
And what goes back to Congress is what's under the jurisdiction of the FDA and the FTC and other government organizations?
Various things. The single most important item would be, can we prevent citizens of the United States from suing the companies? Mm-hmm. You have to pass a law that says you may not sue the companies. And whether that's constitutional or unconstitutional, Congress has to pass a law saying that. And that's what the companies want. They want immunity from prosecution, immunity from suits, immunity from suits of the states, immunity from the Justice Department itself. And Congress is the only one that can do that.
Well, Philip Hiltz, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Philip Hiltz writes about health and science for the New York Times and is the author of Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR News.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Joe Sachs wears two hats. On the weekends, he's an attending physician at the emergency room at Northridge Hospital Medical Center in Los Angeles. On weekdays, he's poring over scripts for the TV series ER, making sure that all the instruments and procedures and language and sounds are true to life and would take place in a real ER. Even though Joe Sachs got his job as medical technical advisor for ER through a chance meeting, he studied both medicine and filmmaking in college, thinking he would do training films for medical staff. In his spare time, he's a flight physician for Air Rescue International. Before we talk with Joe Sachs about bringing reality to a fictional series, let's listen to a scene from last week's show. A seriously ill child has been brought into the emergency room by his mother.
I've got a sick kid here.
Yeah.
He was asleep in his crib. I couldn't wake him up.
How long was he down?
2 minutes. Couldn't get my V. Gave Epi down the tube.
All right.
Excuse me. Joel has a hypoplastic left heart. They put a Blaylock shunt in last month. He was doing fine.
Yeah, what's your name, ma'am?
Andrea Thompson.
Two, three.
I'm Carol Hathaway. This is Dr. Ross.
Give me an arm board and a 22-gauge angiocath. I'll start an IV.
The surgeon's name is Dr. Luce. His cardiologist is Ferris, and his pediatrician is Vargas.
Hook up a 12 lead and get an echo.
He's on DIG, Lasix, and potassium.
Chuny, would you escort Mrs. Thompson out of here?
Come on, sweetheart.
No, please, I want to stay. Carol?
All right, but you stay back there. We need to work.
I'm in bolus 100 of saline.
Did he cut off his shunt?
He may have. Blood gas kit.
What's that for?
Man, I don't have time to explain everything to you right now. She shouldn't be in here.
It's her child.
Chuny, get this up the lab.
I asked Joe Sachs how he choreographs a scene.
The first thing that has to happen, of course, is that we have to get all the supplies that we're going to need. So the prop department may get a list of 200 props that we have to obtain. Some we may have, some we may have to special order or get from manufacturers. The next thing that I need to do is meet with the director and just to go over the medical correctness of the scene, where the principal characters need to be standing to doing certain procedures. And once the director and I are on the same page, I then have to fill in all of the detail and all of the activity that goes on in the room. And that takes about 1 hour per every 40 seconds that you see on the air, the amount of pre-production work to choreograph the movement. In each of the two rooms, there are 8 people approximately working on the patient. There's all of our regulars, and then there are background artists, some of whom are real nurses, to lend additional medical realism to the scene. So I'm choreographing all the movement, all the passing of instruments. So anytime you're seeing Dr. Ross examining the kid in front of his face, they're throwing up and setting IVs, and behind him somebody's running with an X-ray cassette to put under the child to take an X-ray. So all of that activity, all that crazy chaos that you see in our trauma and critical care scenes is choreographed to the very exact move, and everything is cued to the dialogue. Once I've choreographed what each person is doing in the room, it kind of looks like a conductor's score. And then each person gets an individual miniaturized script with all of their technical notes on the scene. So Dr. Ross knows when he says this line, he gets the scalpel from Hathaway. When he says this line, the chest tube is passed from Marquez, and he puts it in. And this really helps the actors because they're not really doctors. So they know exactly what they're doing every moment, every beat of the scene.
Well, I'm curious how much of a medical education you've given the actors and how much you demonstrate the correct way of passing a scalpel from one person to the other, or the correct way of leaning over a baby's body as you're doing some critical form of surgery?
It has to be done really, really fast because we do a lot of work. Our scripts are 80 pages long, which is about twice as long as your average one-hour television script because our pace is so fast. We have so much work to do in a day that I can't waste a lot of time rehearsing and instructing people. So everybody gets about 2 minutes with me before we get to the scene. And then we rehearse the scene maybe 2 or 3 times before we start shooting. So everybody has to learn very quickly. And often the featured aspects of the procedure don't involve the actual surgery and incisions on the body. The producers and the network obviously doesn't want to see that. We don't show a lot of blood and guts. But what we work on is the correctness of how people are handling surgical instruments. And, for instance, a scalpel may be passed through the frame, they'll use it, and when it comes back up to be passed back, it may be bloody. And that gives the impression that a procedure is done, where you're not going to actually see the skin splitting open on a patient.
What about being able to pronounce medical terms, not just correctly, but meaningfully?
I have to correct, and very often, a day or two before we get to a scene, I'll know what are the tough words that someone's going to say, and I'll just kind of go over them so they don't learn them incorrectly. We had a guest star on an upcoming show who has about a 60-second monologue of the most complex, complicated medical terms that he has to rattle off. And for him, I made an audio tape, and he studied that for two or three days, and he came in and just nailed it.
Well, since we're on the radio and I have a partial feeling for sounds, how much are just the sounds of an ER, or even maybe the sounds of a physician putting their hands inside someone's chest cavity, how important is that, you think, in creating an atmosphere of the ER?
Right. Very important. And after a show is edited, I'm very intimately involved in the sound mix for the medical sound effects and the additional background dialogue. The show is filmed with no sound except for the voices of the people who are talking. And when you look at a rough cut of ER, it feels very empty because all you hear is the dialogue. And then we have a fabulous post-production department who goes to work at creating a 48-track sound mix that includes all of the background activity of visitors talking, people talking, nurses talking, all the beeps and the boops of the medical equipment, all of the special sound effects, distant ambulances, wailing, intercoms. And it just really brings it to life. So sound's a very important part of the show.
Are there certain sounds you've had to make that are really the sounds of an ER, or perhaps the sounds of a particular kind of surgery that maybe you can't find on a CD collection?
Oh, yeah. We go to the real hospital and record the real machines and the real monitors. Most of the sound effects that you hear are the real actual medical noises that you would hear in a hospital, just as all of the medical props that you see are the real pieces of medical equipment that are really used in a hospital. I sometimes jokingly say that we're better stocked than many community hospitals are, and it's somewhat true. We could do major procedures and resuscitations right there on the soundstage at Warner Brothers.
Well, what have you found is the hardest procedure to try to recreate on ER? I mean, in certain ways, you want to make it as real as possible, but you do have to think about the camera.
Well, we tend not to feature the real gore and guts of the procedures that are being done on the patient's body. The frame of the camera stays a little bit above it, so we don't have to detail all of that work. So it's a very easy question to answer as to what the hardest procedure to do on camera is, and that's putting on surgical gloves.
Really? Now,
yeah,
why is that?
There's nothing harder than that, because that's something that there's no cheating, there's no hiding. You know, when you take your scalpel or you take your forceps and you dive down below frame, it doesn't matter what you're doing. You know, you could be finger painting down there and no one would know the difference. But when you have a nurse holding out gloves and you got to pop your hand right into it and come up and look like you've done it a million times in your life. And inevitably, when we're doing a scene where someone has to glove up, they'll put their hand down and they'll come up with the thumb and the index finger and the pinky and the middle one, and then there'll be two little bunny rabbit ears sticking up that don't have any fingers in them at all, and we have to cut the camera.
So then it's back to the practice.
So putting on gloves is a really difficult skill, and few people understand that.
Well, what are the medical staff doing below the frame? And it's true, in ER, most of what is going on is implied, and you don't see serious surgery right in the camera, but right below the camera, of course, their hands are out of the camera's eye. Are they doing anything? Are they just...
Oh, sure, they're doing. I teach them the proper moves that they would be doing, because we see their forearm and we see their upper arm, and it has to look like they're sewing or pushing or sliding a tube in. So the upper body moves are all correct. The detail of exactly what they're doing with their fingers and at the end of the surgical instruments is not seen.
Joe Sachs is an emergency room physician and medical technical advisor for the TV series ER. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Joe Sachs is a medical technical advisor to the TV program ER. He's also an emergency room physician. Let me ask you about your own decision to be an emergency room physician. What was it that made you want to specialize in that?
Well, I love it. I love working in emergency departments. Yeah, it's there's a couple of reasons why. I think if you ask anyone, you know, if you ask the first violinist in the New York Philharmonic, well, why do you play the violin? You know, why are you doing that? There's a love for what you do. And I really love working in an emergency department. There's two aspects of it. One is the cognitive or intellectual aspect. People come in off the street with a problem, and you really have to use all of your problem-solving skills to come up with a diagnosis. And I enjoy that part of it, to be the to be on the front line. The other part of it is the interpersonal part of the fact that strangers are coming in and you have to walk into a room and develop an instant rapport with them, put them at ease. They're nervous. They have a perceived emergency. They're afraid. The family's there. They're concerned. And there's really a very magical moment where you can go into the room, kind of break through all that, relax people, put them at ease, make them laugh, And that, for me, is very rewarding. So there's the two aspects of that I really enjoy. And then the third aspect is that emergency medicine, unlike some of the other specialties, gives you a lot of flexibility in terms of pursuing other interests. You work shifts in the emergency department. So your schedule is known in advance. You don't have to have a beeper. You're not called back to the hospital. You're not on call. So many emergency physicians have and pursue other interests. And for me, had I not been in the specialty of emergency medicine, I wouldn't be able to devote as much time as I can to the show and still keep my hand in clinical medicine.
When you're working in the real ER, the real emergency room, do you sometimes say to yourself, oh, okay, I got to remember this and perhaps incorporate it on the show ER?
Absolutely. In fact, most of our stories come from real emergency department experiences with real patients. We change them and we modify them to protect the innocent. And no one's story is ever told verbatim. But certainly interesting situations, conflicts, dilemmas, hilarious moments, I do make notes of. And sometimes they'll end up in a distorted form on the show. But I think it's just like any writer, you have life experiences, and when something happens to you, you decide to use it.
Yeah. Last year you wrote one of the shows, A Shift in the Night, and this was about an all-nighter that Dr. Green pulled in the emergency room. Was that based on a night of yours?
It was an amalgam of several nights. There are some nights where you are inundated and overwhelmed by patients and by the healthcare system, and no matter what you do trying to take a step forward, you get pushed back several steps, and it's really frustrating. You try to do the right thing, and perhaps somebody's managed care organization or HMO doesn't want the patient admitted to the hospital, so you have to kind of do battle with that. You want to admit patients to the hospital, but there are no beds. You want to take care of people, but you're just overwhelmed and you're feeling bad because people are waiting a long time and they're getting angry. And sometimes you just wish you could wave a magic wand and take care of everyone without all the red tape of the system. And that's kind of what the episode was about. And it was a basis of, it was based on two things, one of which was the day of the big earthquake in Southern California. The Northridge earthquake had its epicenter at the hospital where I work.
Wow.
So instead of seeing 100 or 150 patients a day, we saw 500 patients that day. The electricity was out, the backup power was on, and we saw 500 patients with more efficiency and with shorter waiting times than we normally do because there were no charts, there was no registration. We were set up outside to do virtually all wound care, including suturing in the parking lot. And to get inside, you needed to be really sick or need an x-ray. So I kind of had an epiphany when I was working there on the day of the earthquake and putting a cast on somebody's leg, and I looked at their little slip at what time they had signed in outside at the in the parking lot. And in less than an hour, they had been seen, been examined, had their x-ray taken, been casted, and had their prescription for pain medicine, which is pretty much unheard of on a normal day. You can often wait an hour just to make your chart and have your personal data entered into the computer. So this episode was about cutting through all the red tape, and Dr. Green did a heroic thing, which is when the emergency department was gridlocked, when nothing was going right. He went out to the waiting room with a few doctors and a few nurses and just saw and took care of as many people as he could right out there in the waiting room.
How did you get this job?
It was pure chance. It was pure chance. I actually came on the show halfway through the first season. And my entree to the show was a phone call to the hospital where I work that came well before the show was on the air. One of the writer producers, whose name is Paul Manning, was doing his research, just talking to real emergency physicians, well before the show was on the air. And he happened to call the hospital where I work, and the person he talked to put him in touch with me. So we got to talking, and I told him a little bit about my background. At that time, Dr. Lance Gentile, who's still on the writing staff, was with the show and was trying to cover the set at the same time that he was attending writing meetings, and that proved to be impossible. So my initial role and responsibility was that actors and writers would come to the real ER and kind of hang out with me just to get a feel for how things work and the vibe and the lingo and the interactions that, that go on. And then halfway through the first season, Lance was just overwhelmed between writing and trying to cover the set, and it became clear that they needed someone like me on the set all the time.
Have you ever appeared in one of the scenes in the background?
Yeah, I actually had a speaking part.
Did you really? Yeah. What was that part?
I think I've been on the air about 3 times. There was a show called Motherhood in the first season that was written by Lydia Woodward, one of our executive producers, and directed by Quentin Tarantino. Hmm. And in that episode, there was a patient who had a cardiac and respiratory arrest while eating at an all-you-can-eat buffet. And I was the paramedic who brought him in. So I came running down the hall, giving the bullet, as we say, explaining exactly what was wrong with him until we transferred him on the bed in the trauma room. And this particular patient had aspirated or inhaled his partial denture plate. And Dr. Lewis had to go fishing for that and pull out a partial plate of dentures from his windpipe.
Was that a thrill for you? To play
was,
somebody on
it the, was the, it was all right. There was a tremendous amount of ribbing from the actors and the crew because normally I'm in the position where I'm always going in and correcting them and giving them advice, and I'm sure there are times when they resent that. So on the first take, when I perhaps didn't do my delivery as quickly or as sparkling as the director wanted it, Eric LaSalle was all over me, giving me a hard time, trying to get me to screw up. But we did 2 takes of the scene coming down the hall. They printed the second one, and that was it. So I was proud of my performance.
Well, you have a show coming up in May, one that you wrote called Make a Wish. Is there anything you can tell us about it?
Well, I wrote the story, and Lydia Woodward wrote the teleplay. And it is the second to last show of the year. And for those of you who are following the show and watch the show, they know that Peter Benton's girlfriend, Carla, is pregnant. Right. And this is the show where the baby's born. So a great deal of the show focuses on that.
Well, Jill Sachs, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Joe Sachs is an emergency room physician and a medical technical advisor for the TV series ER. Coming up, the news that everyone knows, Ellen is a lesbian. We get a review of tonight's show from TV critic David Bianculli. This is Fresh Air. Tonight on Ellen, after months of teasing and talking and promoting and waiting, the character played by Ellen DeGeneres comes out as a lesbian, something the actress herself has already done this month in Time magazine and in a TV interview with Diane Sawyer. TV critic David Bianculli has seen the one-hour episode and was pleasantly surprised.
There's been so much hype about Ellen coming to terms with her sexual orientation, Ellen the actress as well as Ellen the sitcom character. It's hard to imagine this week's show living up to it. But it does. It's even savvy enough to start out by making fun of the whole thing, including the long delay between the original announcement and this one-hour special, in a scene where Ellen is getting dressed in the next room while her friends wait impatiently.
Ellen, you're going to be late for your dinner date with your old college friend Richard.
I can't believe it.
What, that Ellen has a date?
No, that she went to college.
I thought she's been in there forever.
Ellen, are you coming out or not?
Yeah, Ellen, quit jerking us around and come out already!
What is the big deal? I've got a whole hour.
The plot of this expanded episode is pretty straightforward. Instead of getting involved with her old friend Richard, Ellen is attracted to his friend Susan, who happens to be gay. Susan, played by guest star Laura Dern, thinks Ellen is gay too. Ellen denies it, but then thinks about it, dreams about it, and even talks to her therapist about it. The therapist is played by Oprah Winfrey, and the mixture of honesty and humor in their exchanges is one reason this episode works so well. All Ellen wants, she tells her therapist, is a normal life, someone to love, and someone who loves her.
I just want to be happy.
And you think you can't have these things with a woman?
Well, society has a pretty big problem with it, you know? I mean, there are a lot of people out there who think people like me are sick. Oh, God, why did I ever rent Personal Best?
You can't blame this on the media, Ellen. It isn't going to be easy. No one has it easy.
See, you don't understand. Do you think I want to be discriminated against? Do you think that I want people calling me names to my face?
To have people commit hate crimes against you just because you're not like them.
Thank you.
To have to use separate bathrooms and separate water fountains and sit in the back of the bus.
Oh, man, we have to use separate water fountains?
There's a dream sequence in this episode that makes room for everyone from Billy Bob Thornton to Demi Moore and from Gina Gershon to K.D. Lang. It's a riot. And so is the entire hour, which manages to make its point without being exploitive or overt. Ellen plants only one romantic kiss in the entire episode, and it's during a fantasy sequence with a guy. The only problem with the show is that the studio audience, like everyone else in America, knows what to expect. Imagine how much more effective this Ellen episode could have been if ABC had just sprung it on viewers. But for the network, telling people in advance was the price to pay for a shot at drawing a much larger audience. Will Ellen get a lot of viewers this week? Sure. But what matters is what happens in the weeks after that. And that's true for the show's content as well. Yes, Ellen is the first name-in-the-title sitcom character to come out as gay. Unless you count Love, Sidney, the early 80s Tony Randall sitcom based on his Sidney Shore telemovie. The disclaimer there, though, is that Sidney was identified as gay in the movie, but never was in the series. So in that sense, Ellen the sitcom really is making history. What will matter more in the long run, though, is not how it makes history, but how it makes comedy. And since this week's show is the funniest episode of Ellen I've ever seen, and I've been watching since it premiered 3 years ago under the title These Friends of Mine, it's definitely starting off in the right direction.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program today was produced by Joan Tuohy-Westman and Roberta Shorrock. Interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.